Dragon, I am the dragon. You are the dragon. We are the dragon. Dragons will fly through the sky, through your eye. Do not deny the dragon's cry.
Welcome to Analog Thoughts, episode 18. I am your host, Steven, aka Mount Analog. Life has been really good recently. My son Felix is thriving. He is learning. He is growing. He is becoming aware of more and more things each day. It's very surreal to watch him grow and to watch his mind expand. And it's trippy, super trippy. I've been working on podcast episodes. I've been working on music. I've been working on some show bookings. I have also started, I haven't told anyone this, but I've started dabbling in writing just a little bit. I have like 10 paragraphs written of the story. And I don't know, I've never written before, but I mean, I have written some like short stories and I've written like scripts for silly videos and stuff like that, but I've never sat down and been like, let's write a fully fleshed out like short story or book. I don't know how long this thing I'm writing is going to be. I'm just literally winging it. And I was looking at like methods on like building a universe and building how to like develop characters and stuff, and a lot of stuff I was reading was like you can only kind of do so much in terms of like universe building. You have to just kind of have like a skeleton, like a framework, and then you just have to start writing and let the story sort of organically manifest itself, because there's only so much prep work you can do. Like, the story's got to be alive, and it's got to be moving, and it's got to be, it's got to kind of take on this life of its own. So that's been really, really fun. It's cool to, it's like an art, like I said, it's an art form that I've not dabbled in super heavily, and it's fun to, like, be in control of this universe, but also to, at the same time, it's like, you kind of are at the whim of the universe, or like it takes the reins, it takes control. It's a lot like any other form of art, like music or writing. Like, you are giving it input, but also at the same time, it is existing on its own, and it's kind of out of your control to a degree. So that's been really cool, communicating with the writing gods and figuring all that out. Or not even figuring it out, but just experiencing it. And as far as control goes, I wanted to kind of touch on that a little bit in terms of mental health. Like, art is like that with control, where like you manifest the idea and you kind of steer the idea, and it exists on its own and has its own. The idea has its own ideas. But with our minds and with our lives, sometimes it can get overwhelming when we feel like we are not in control. But I just want to remind everyone listening that you are in control. You are the captain of your story. You are the writer of your story, and you can make changes. You can edit things. You can change the course of the story that you're in. It's never too late to omit characters or write in new characters or write in new ways that you think you need to grow and develop. You are in control. So if you're feeling overwhelmed, or when you're feeling overwhelmed about like, oh man, I have no options here, just know that even though this story that's existing, the story that's existing and growing around you, even though it does have a life of its own, you are the writer. You are in control. You are the author. And just breathe, and don't let your mind trick you into thinking you are without control because you have maximum potential and you have maximum control. Empower yourself, baby! Other life updates. I planted some pumpkins, got a bike trailer for Felix, and we've been going on bike rides. My indoor plants are doing very well, too. I've got some succulents, a cactus, some ferns, but I've got a handful of them. They're mostly, like, ferny and succulent-y because they're indoor and they're, like, hardy and, you know, they get, like, indirect sunlight. But anyway, been doing a lot of planting. I've also been focusing on releasing a new single, like, every other week. I have one coming out on the 30th that is called I Like You. It's already out on my Patreon now, so if you're one of my patrons, you've already heard it. And also, if you're one of my patrons, thank you, I love you. Mwah. Today we're going to talk about dragons, because really, just why not? I want to talk about the origins of dragons. I want to talk about, I want to talk about both their fictional origins and how they relate to culture and customs across the world. And I think I kind of picked this topic because I've been just reading. So I've been like reading and listening to audiobooks of so many fantasy novels recently. And I've been writing. It's funny because even though I've been doing that, the type of story that I'm making is a little more science fiction-y than fantasy, but I've been reading a lot of fantasy, and it just, like, sparked this idea of I want to do something. I want to do, like, what's the most classic fantasy element, or, like, one of the most classic fantasy creatures, and I was like, dragons. I might also do another one on wizards, I don't know, but that was the first one that popped into my head, so I was like, dragons, let's run it. I also wrote down wizards, so there may be a wizards episode, possibly directly after this one. They are considered strange and mystical. They're revered and respected, and they are presently in fantasy, while also being connected to reality in myths, legends, and ancient cultures. They're truly magical beings that kind of blur the lines between these realms. There's many different kinds of dragons. There are serpent dragons that we see represented in Asian cultures and stories, and then there's the more flying lizard type dragons that pop up in countless European tales and folklore. And then we have hybrids of different types of dragons throughout fiction and fantasy. We have fire dragons, ice dragons, good dragons, bad dragons, dragons with human faces, god dragons. Every culture has their own spin on what a dragon is and why they're important. And the overall concept of dragons has gone through countless mutations over time. And when most of us think of dragons, the giant, scaled, fire-breathing monster is usually what comes to mind. However, like I said, like I've already said, this wasn't always the case. When we go back thousands of years to Greek mythology, we can see that they had lots of creatures in their tales that resembled dragons, but didn't necessarily fit the modern description of what a dragon is or looks like or does. The word dragon actually comes from the Greek word drakoume, which means to see or to stare. And a little side note here, if you're a Tolkien fan like me, this will make sense as to why his dragons are always hypnotizing people or putting them under spells while they stare at them. Because, like, J.R.R. Tolkien, being the linguistic master that he was, this all starts to make sense with Smaug, Glaurung, that they would have these powers of hypnosis, since the word dragons is spawned from a Greek word that means to see or to stare. That's why his dragons always are staring and hypnotizing and putting people under spells with their eyes. Anyway, that's nerd stuff. This entire episode is actually nerd stuff, so it fits in. It fits in here. Like I was saying, none of the Greek dragons really look like what we think of dragons today. More so, they resemble giant slithering serpents with rows and rows of razor-sharp teeth. And there are some really cool depictions of them in their art. They look like kind of how you think they would. They're giant gnarly snake monsters, and they're usually depicted eating people, eating ships, or destroying towns and killing people. They also had dragons and serpents with many heads, and these serpents were usually guarding treasures, or they were guarding sacred, whimsical, mystical areas or realms. One such dragon appears in an old tale called Jason and the Argonauts, and he guards this piece of magical fleece that is hanging from a tree in a forbidden grove. And then, of course, we have the Hydra style of dragon that pops up in a bunch of Greek stories. And it's a dragon, serpent, monster with a whole bunch of heads. Like, you chop one head off, and then another head would regenerate from the stump. Or sometimes, like, chopping a head off would have two heads sprout from that stump. And I kind of wish that humans had this ability. I wish I could chop off a finger and then, like, sprout two more fingers from that stump. Like, or chop off my arm and get, like, two more arms. And I think people would just, if we did have that ability, people would be chopping their limbs off all the time. Like, people would just be like, but then it's like, if you chop your own head off, would you get another head? Like, and would that head have its own, like, autonomy? Would it have, like, a separate brain from your brain? Or would your brain function as the mind for that head? I don't know. I know starfish have regenerative properties, and some lizards do too. Like, if you chop off a limb or a finger, or I guess a claw, they can, like, regenerate, which is just crazy to me, like, thinking about that. But also kind of makes me think of how stem cell research works, how, like, we can grow an organ in a tube with stem cells, or, like, we can pretty much grow a whole nother human with a stem cell. Like, there's this base code genetic material. And it also makes me wonder if someday we might be able to, like, grow a non-human thing from a human piece of stem cell. Or could we, like, fuse the DNA? That's probably already happening. Scientists are probably already fusing animal DNA with human stem cells to make, like, human-animal hybrids behind the scenes. It's all behind the scenes. Anyway, I kind of got off on a tangent there. Let's get back to dragons. So I want to talk a little bit about a creature in Greek mythology called the Chimera. And the Chimera, although its actual appearance isn't super similar to medieval dragons, it's seen as being possibly the influence for the inception of medieval dragons, even though it's like in Greek mythology, it's not talked about super often. And it is one of the least dragon-esque monsters. Like, it's still considered, like, a primary influence. I'll get into why. As a creature, the Chimera's front half is a lion. The middle part and back legs are that of a goat, and it actually had another head, a goat's head, on this middle/back section. So think of it, I know that gets a little confusing, but think of it like lion's head up front, and then a goat's head in the middle, like punching out of the chest, and then the hind parts of the Chimera are all snake-like and, like, scaly. It actually has a tail that has a snake head at the end of the tail. And I know what you're probably thinking, like, how did this unholy abomination of a creature, how is this responsible for the creation of a medieval dragon? Even though it didn't exactly look like a medieval dragon, it had a lot of similarities. The goat head that stuck out of the middle could breathe fire. And it also saw scales taking a more prominent role in the creature. Like, before the Chimera, the serpent creatures in Greek mythology were smoother and, like, not as scaly. And perhaps the biggest reason that the Chimera is an influence in making the medieval version of dragons is that there's a Greek story that it's featured in, and it's slain by a Greek hero named Bellerophon. In this story, where Bellerophon slays the Chimera, was, we'll just say, adopted into a medieval story about Saint George slaying a dragon. not only was the story lifted, the iconography and artwork also directly resembles the Greek tale of the Chimera. So this new tale, lifted from the old tale, sees the shape and the style and the vibe of the Chimera mutated into the medieval perception of the dragon. Dragons were the monster of choice for the medieval period. Some of this influence comes from the Greeks and Romans, and some from Christianity. And we get all these tales written and rewritten and shared about valiant knights and saints saving towns and villages from dragons. And with these stories, the perception of what the dragon is changing. They're no longer protectors of treasures and mythical places. They become full-on terrors, dark, almost demonic forces that destroy and kill and eat people. And then we see, of course, Christianity getting a deeper hold onto things. And this is actually how that story I mentioned earlier about St. George comes into play. So in order to really talk about this, I'm going to briefly gloss over that story. There's a village that is watched over by a dragon. And by watched over, I basically mean extorted. The dragon promises not to burn the village down or let anything else attack the village. If the villagers give the dragon an offering of livestock and riches every so often. And eventually the dragon's demand outweighs what the village is capable of giving. So the villagers have no other choice but to start giving the dragon humans as a sacrifice.
Menemene, give me your firstborn, I need more blood. Menemene, I will burn your village down.
Eventually, the princess of the village was chosen as the sacrifice. And at this point, in rolls St. George. He is a respected Christian soldier, and he rolls up, rescues the princess, and promises to slay the dragon if the villagers all become Christians. They accept, and George cuts the head off the dragon. And there's way more to this story than that, but in a nutshell, that's it. Honestly, for me, it's kind of like a jerk move for St. George to roll up and be like, hey, I'll kill this dragon, but you guys all gotta change your faith, or else I'm just gonna let the dragon go. Like, what an a-hole, dude. This story, and the story it was lifted from, about the Chimera, are the archetypes for so many modern tales about knights and dragons and bravery and courage. So just a little recap on that. The Greek story of the Chimera gets retold where the hero is St. George, and then the narrative of the Christian churches in European areas is intertwined into the story, making it so the dragon is almost becomes the symbol for the devil, and that the hero of Christianity is saving people from the devil. But that's kind of like the Christians were doing what every artist does. They're stealing. They're lifting from other stories. They're mutating stories. They're retelling stories with their own spin on them. And that's kind of how, even beyond the Christian church, that's how stories are. If you listen to my episode about the Brothers Grimm fairy tales, then you've already heard how some of these stories have mutated over time. And Every classic story that we know and love is nothing like its origins. There's this quote from Pablo Picasso, and I'm sure you've heard it before, but it's that good artists borrow and great artists steal. And you can see this thievery, if you want to call it that, this artistic thievery in every form of art. It's not only is it in stories, it's in music, it's in cinema. It's in everything. Every artist is stealing and mutating. Whether it's a subconscious thievery or not, it's happening no matter what. I mean, that's really how we use the term inspiration. Like, what inspires you? What artists are you most inspired by? Like, asking that question is also kind of asking, like, which artists are you stealing the most from creatively? And like I said, it's not a malicious thievery, I don't think, even though I think in the Christian sense of stealing this story and embedding their philosophies in it, it is a bit more twisted and weird because you're trying to indoctrinate people via the art. But the fact that no matter what kind of art you're getting into, is still what kind of art you're creating, that sentiment still remains. Like, if you are a creator, you are actively lifting, stealing, influenced, whatever you want to call it, by other pieces of art. But honestly, I don't mean to paint that in like a negative way. I think that art is alive and it's constantly being reborn. It's constantly being mutated. And that's just the essence of art and the human experience. It's really beautiful. It's a really beautiful thing. I don't want to sound like pessimistic about this. It's just part of the creative process in general. Like, I know I keep referencing Tolkien, but if it weren't for all of the folklore that existed before the stories that he wrote, none of the stories he wrote would exist. You know, he didn't invent dwarves and goblins and ancient gods and elves. Like, all those things existed before he picked up a pen or sat in front of a typewriter. And that's happening today in all genres, fantasies, science fiction, horror. They're all pulling from and a lot of times they're paying homage to the things that they love. The creators are like, I respect and revere this thing so much. It's had such an influence on my life. Here is a reinterpretation of this energy. And I wasn't sure if I was going to talk about this next point, but I'm going to talk about it anyway because I feel like it's relevant to what I'm explaining. So there's this situation or this like flux of energy between Jimi Hendrix and Muddy Waters, where Jimi Hendrix is like, he's this new, back in the 60s, he's like this new up and coming rock god. He's this rock prodigy. Funk, soul, rock, fusion prodigy, and he is heavily inspired by Muddy Waters, who is, if you're not familiar with Muddy Waters, he's like a blues man. He's like a blues guy who like uses an acoustic guitar, and he sings his songs of agony and his songs of kind of despair, and it's very like minimal, bluesy, very like stripped down. But then Jimi Hendrix takes this vibe, this energy, and reformats it into what we know Jimi Hendrix for, like pretty wild guitar solos and like bombastic electric guitar playing and stuff. And you know, his career develops and he comes to a position of fame, and eventually Muddy Waters hears Jimi Hendrix's music and he's like, wow, this is insane. And he recognizes what Jimi Hendrix is doing in terms of like using this blues, these like blues riffs, and introducing them in a new way, introducing them into this like into the zeitgeist of like rock and funk electric guitar fusion that was really popular in the 60s. So Muddy Waters decides he wants to do that as well. So Muddy Waters releases an album called Electric Mud, which is directly inspired by the Jimi Hendrix style of psychedelic funk rock fusion that was going on at the time. So it's just a cool, it literally comes full circle back to Muddy Waters, the inspiration that he embedded into music mutates and transforms, actually like reverberates back to him, echoes back to him, and he gets inspired by his own node of inspiration, and then they told two friends, and they told two friends, and it turns into this huge web of of music and creation and influence. And that's just, that's how art works. It's this constantly mutating and changing alive organism. It doesn't just like, anytime I feel like someone wants to like purists, there's a lot of like pure art and music and cinema purists out there. I feel like they themselves need to reevaluate what art is and why it's constantly changing and like why it's important for it to change. I don't think being a purist is a good thing. Anyway, back to dragons. Over the years, these stories start to develop, and there are more stories being written about saints and warriors and knights slaying dragons. And eventually, the symbol of the dragon is thought to become a symbol for pagan beliefs. And the saints, as this pure Christian religion that is slaying, that they're slaying the pagan belief system. Side note here, I'm going to be pimping my podcast out on this podcast, but side note here, if you want to learn more about the Christian impact and destruction of ancient pagan beliefs, check out my episodes on Halloween and Christmas. Shameless plug, shameless plug. Not even the dragons are safe from the Christian virus that plagued the world. And it's like, it's nothing sacred, Jesus. Can't we at least have dragons? Can't you just give us dragons? You gotta influence dragons? Come on, man. So the stories further develop in the mode of Christianity. Dragons show up and they just start killing and eating people who have sinned. They kill the sinners. And all the while, these stories, dragons are physically changing shape. They're getting more bat-like wings. They're getting fiercer. They're becoming more demonic looking, and they're starting to have the typical like one head, bat wings, four legs. But that's not to say that specific archetype of dragon became the standard all across Europe. Because in all across Europe, dragons were being categorized now. There were bestiaries being written. There were two-legged dragons coming from some areas, four-legged dragons from other areas, thick and fat dragons from some areas, and then skinny, kind of more serpentine ones from others. So they're changing, they're mutating. There's a whole web of Christian influence. There's a whole web of dragon lore and dragon variety that's happening all across Western Europe and Eastern Europe. And eventually, dragons start popping up on crests and flags and banners. Even if you look at the Welsh flag today, it has this fierce-looking red dragon on it. And the red dragon is supposed to symbolize the Britons. And there's an old Welsh story that depicts this red dragon defending villages from a white dragon, which the white dragon is meant to symbolize the Saxon invaders. So now it's becoming part of pop culture. People are wearing it with pride. They're putting it on their crests. They're throwing it on their jerseys. They're like, let's go. Dragons are tight. And dragons are tight. It becomes more this like larger than life symbol where you can be like, we align ourselves with the idea of a fierce dragon. And even though the nature of the dragon is vilified by Christianity, it also becomes the symbol of ferocity in areas where they like resonate with the spirit of the dragon and resonate with the power of the dragon. That kind of segues into what I want to talk about next, which is I haven't even talked about Asian dragons in Asia. Historically speaking, Asian dragons came first, unless you count Egypt. But we'll kind of get into the Egyptian version of their dragon a little bit later. But dragons were found in Asia way before Europe, and honestly, before the Greeks, as far as historians can tell. If that seems a little confusing, just for a frame of reference, as far as history goes in terms of cultures, from oldest to newest, things go Egypt, China, Greek, and then the Romans, obviously, after that. Before the Greek dragons, we had Chinese dragons. There's a lot of debate as to whether Chinese civilization in general actually did come before Greek civilization, just for a variety of reasons, which honestly, put me into a Googling vortex as to, like, where was China first? And for everything I could find, and after asking ChatGPT, and after asking Bard AI on Google, and after, like, looking at a bunch of documents, looking at Wikipedia, I actually spent some time on this, I came to the conclusion that Chinese civilization did, in fact, come before Greek civilization. Just in general. And that debate is really caused by when language emerged in both civilizations and when archaeologists found signs of settlements in both places. However you dice it, China wins out in the dragon game here. They had dragons first. And although their dragons are older, it's generally thought that they didn't have an impact on the creation of the Greek dragons. That's kind of why I split this podcast into two different sections. The Greek dragons that go on to influence European dragons, and then this section, which is the Chinese dragons, that go on to influence the rest of Asia. They're two very different versions of dragons. Ancient pieces of Chinese pottery and jade sculptures have been found long, long before other dragon-related artifacts from other parts of the world. And dragons throughout Asia have a similar appearance to those in Europe. Kind of like, they're serpent-y. They're snake-like creatures. Some of them fly, some of them don't. Some breathe fire, some don't. But the way that they really differ from European dragons is what they symbolize. In Europe, the dragon grew to become known as a symbol for fear and death, and literally, in parts of Europe, the presence of evil or the presence of the devil. And in Asia, they're known for just the opposite. Dragons are signs of good fortune, good luck, and prosperity, strength and power. And often warriors or people of high esteem would be compared to dragons. In their mythology and storytelling, dragons are at the very top of creatures that are revered. Heroes and gods rode dragons, and for centuries, dragons were associated with emperors, which makes sense considering their affiliation with power and prowess. There are even some stories that say that there are emperors or warriors that are descendants of dragons, and also Asian dragons are seen as rulers and producers and protectors of water, waterfalls and rivers and seas. So the dragons in China and other regions of Asia are considered to be gods of water, which also is kind of like parallels like gods of life. Like water and life in a lot of mythology is intertwined. And life and the sun. Sun and water and elemental gods and elemental creatures are always like paralleled with being producers of life, usually. In China, there are four major bodies of water. And I wrote down the names of these four seas in China, these four great bodies of water, but I'm not going to put you through me butchering their names, because I am not... I don't speak Mandarin, and I feel like I'd be doing these names a great disservice. But if you are interested in those names, just Google it, and you can see the four major bodies of... There's one in the east, one in the north, one in the south, one in the west. So, not only are dragons seen as protectors of these bodies of water and the resources that they hold, they were and are seen as creatures that control these bodies of water and control rain, and control weather. I know that I mentioned Egypt had a little tiny bit in the history of dragons too. Like, they have a little nugget of dragon history. Which you'd think in all of Egypt, which, shameless plug here, I do have an episode that's all about ancient Egypt, so go check that one out if you want to hear more about their gods and deities. But anyway, considering all of their gods and deities, they had hundreds, and there's only really two creatures that resemble dragons in Egyptian mythology. The first one I'm not really going to talk about. It was the steed of one of their gods, and it's really more kind of like a griffin type thing, kind of eagly, less dragony. But this, the one I do want to talk about, the one that does more so resemble the likeness of a dragon, was a creature named Apep. And Apep looks like a giant cobra. And every night when the sun went down, the Egyptians thought that the sun god Ra would go into the underworld. You know, they'd see the sun set and they're like, Ra is entering the underworld. And every night Ra would battle Apep. Apep is to them was a god of chaos. It was this cobra god of chaos and destruction that didn't want the sun to rise again in the morning. And he would swim in the waters of the underworld as Ra was in the underworld in his boat waiting to have the sun rise again in the morning. And he would do battle with Apep every single night. And when the sun rose in the morning, the Egyptians would be like, ah, Ra won again against the cobra Apep in the underworld. We are getting a new day. So each new day was a victory for them and for Ra against the demonic water cobra. Hey yo, so this is like the middle of the show, and I wanted to, first of all, thank everyone for dialing into this podcast. I'm glad that you're here, and I'm glad that you are sharing this experience with me. If you'd like to support the podcast, leaving a 5-star rating on whatever platform you're listening to this on goes a really, really long way. Also, if you are able to leave a review for the podcast, that also goes an extremely long way. Another way you can support the podcast, other than just telling your friends and family about it, is signing up on my Patreon. There is a link in the description of this episode and all the episodes, or you can just go to patreon.com and search for Mount Analog, MT.ANALOGUE. You get early access to podcasts, early access to my music, early access to art, and all kinds of other cool stuff. However you support, I cannot thank you enough. Infinite, infinite, infinite thank yous. I love you. Infinite blessings to you. Let's get back to the podcast. And speaking of super ancient civilizations, there is actually evidence of dragons found in Mesoamerica as well. They're not out of this dragon party. Long before European sails appeared on their shores, the Aztecs had Quetzalcoatl. And Quetzalcoatl was related to wind, Venus, the sun, merchants, arts, crafts, knowledge, and learning. He was also the patron god of the Aztec priesthood. He was basically a dragon of art and knowledge. He was also responsible for bringing corn to the Aztec people. See my episode about the ancient Mayans and their relationship to corn, and you will see how corn is a very important piece of Mesoamerican cultures. Anyway, Quetzalcoatl is cool. He's this giant green, yellow, and red serpent, and he can be seen all throughout Aztec temples and on their pottery and on their art and on their pieces of their weapons that have been found. And even India has dragons. There's a Hindu god named Vertara that is represented as a snake in their Vedas, that is also a god of waters and rainfalls, just like the Chinese dragons. So this brings me to an interesting point. Why throughout human history have all of the civilizations on Earth come up with some form of dragon creature, some kind of flying serpent creature? And some historians think it's because of humanity's general fear of snakes, and there are actually studies that indicate we have a biological response to snakes. The caution, or at least the general reaction we have to snakes, is potentially cooked into our DNA. It's a survival instinct. Like, Snakes are weird. Maybe bad. Increase adrenaline. Dilate pupils. Sweat. Proceed with caution. I'm really just simplifying it, though. There are actually studies that neuroscientists have done that track our amygdala response when we are in the presence of snakes. And there is a definite reaction every time. Even if you're like, I'm not afraid of snakes, which I don't consider myself afraid of snakes. I'm okay handling snakes. I don't have a problem with it. I obviously wouldn't want to hold like a venomous, ferocious snake. But whether you're afraid of snakes or not, just in general, you can't deny that you have a sensation when you're around them. You have a physical reaction to them in some capacity. It's just part of human DNA, literally. And snakes are the number one reported phobia for people. So maybe that's why we've created dragons. It's this, you know, they're this manifestation of our subconscious fears or triggers. And whether humanity realizes it or not, maybe dragons are a result of this biological entanglement that we have to them. We've turned these snakes into larger-than-life creatures that should be feared, or at least respected, because of their power. This also raises the question, like, dragons do look like snakes, but what about their faces? They're not really snake-like. They usually look like long, like, horse faces or camel faces. And historians also have an interesting reason for this, too. And that's dinosaurs. We weren't the first people to discover dinosaur bones or fossils in this modern age. They've been discovering dinosaur bones for thousands of years before us. See my episode on dinosaur extinction. Plug, 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 shameless plug. Anyway, that's partially why dragons are depicted like this, or so it's believed. Ancient civilizations found bones of dinosaurs and started coming up with what they could have been. Things with long faces, with horns, things they thought that would have been these giant scaly creatures. And also, dinosaurs existed all over the world. There are dinosaur fossils on every continent, and fossils that could have potentially spawned stories across the globe. And during the mass extinction event, a lot of dinosaurs died together during the asteroid impact 65 million years ago. There are certainly, all across Earth, piles of dinosaur bones and fossils from different creatures that would have been that could have been misinterpreted as belonging to one singular creature. So, like, you know, all these dinosaurs are squatted up, asteroid hits, they all get killed all at once, and then there's like a pile of dinosaur bones, and people digging them up thousands of years ago or finding them thousands of years ago, and they could have just been like, what is this massive creature? This is huge. And like, even though dinosaurs were huge, they could have been like lumping in piles of dinosaur bones all together and saying that this thing had multiple heads and it had, you know, six legs and like five tails, and they could have been like misinterpreting vertebrae as like wings, who knows. But all of that, of course, is, you know, it's just theories. No one will ever really know where the idea of dragons actually comes from. It could just come from imagination. It could come from telling campfire stories and saying, I saw a snake, it was freaking huge. And then, you know, that story of like sweeping a snake out of your garden, a huge snake out of your garden, turns into, yeah, the snake, it was 10 feet long. And then, you know, you're by another campfire and you're trying to entertain and you're like, yeah, that snake was 20 feet long, and so on until it becomes, this snake was the size of my house. And it could have come from that. It could have just come from creative storytelling. I personally like to think that dragons were real. in all of their varieties, the demons, the protectors, the harbingers of doom, the respected godlike water dragons. I want them to all be real. Who knows? Maybe dragons were real. Which this also brings me to another very important question. Is Yoshi from the Super Mario Brothers franchise a dragon? I know, he looks like a dinosaur, but also he eats tortoise shells and then can breathe fire after eating the shells. So I dug up the manual from Nintendo from 1993, and the manual regarding the Super Mario Brothers universe sees Yoshi referred to as a dinosaur, but his scientific name is listed as Yoshisaurus manchacupas, which leads me to believe that he is a relative of the Koopas, who are descendants of Bowser. And Bowser is often referred to as a turtle dragon. And if Bowser is in fact part dragon, and Yoshi is in fact related to Bowser, is Yoshi also not part dragon? These are the questions that keep me up at night. These are the true things I want answers to. I need answers. If you can weigh in on this, send me a message, send me an email. Is Yoshi at least part dragon? Because I feel like he is. I feel like he definitely is. I'll be patiently awaiting your emails. Also, I'd like to talk a little more about specific dragons of worldly significance in different cultures. Just because I feel like there are so many dragons across the world, I can't talk about all of them, but I want to talk a little bit about some that are of culturals other than Yoshi. I want to talk about some other dragons that are of large cultural significance. The first one I want to talk about is Bakunawa. This dragon comes from the Philippines and is known as the Eater of Moons. The story goes that Bakunawa was around a long, long time ago in an age where Earth had 7 moons. And Bakunawa was obsessed with the moons, their glow, their beauty. But admiring them from afar wasn't enough. Bakunawa decided to eat the 7 moons. And the people of Earth played drums and they made loud noises and they sang for pity to try to convince Bakunawa to put the moons back in the sky. And when the Spaniards eventually made their way to the Philippines in the 1600s, they heard this tale and turned Bakunawa into a word for evil, or Satan, just like what had happened all across Europe in the medieval ages. So the story develops over time, and some versions of the story see Bakunawa spitting the moons back out as a show of pity to the people of Earth, and some show Bakunawa facing off with saints, like the previous stories, where the saints destroy Bakunawa and retrieve one of the moons from his stomach. Another interesting fact about Bakunawa is that in many parts of Southeast Asia, that name, which translates to moon eater or man eater, is used as a slang term for corrupt politicians or greedy people. We've got a lot of Bakunawas in our government in the United States. The next dragon I want to talk about is Nidhogg. Nidhogg is a dragon from Norse mythology. He feasts on the roots of a tree that support the 9 realms, the nine realms of Norse mythology. So these, like, in Norse mythology, there are 9 realms of existence that you can exist upon. But Nidhogg lives under the tree of the realms of existence, and he feasts on the roots. He's kind of like a god of another god of chaos, another agent of darkness. He was referred to by the Norse people as the Malice Striker. And Nidhogg looks like a version of the medieval Hollywood-esque dragons. Giant horns, giant bat-like wings, scales, an immense tail, ferocious claws. Nidhogg, however, was just two-legged, and it's said that under his bat-like wings, he carried the bodies of deceased criminals. And he also had dealings with the goddess of the underworld. And he, like most elemental creatures of chaos throughout mythology, wasn't really regarded as evil. Although, yes, he did do terrible, evil things, he was seen rather as a negative natural force of darkness, of death, a vital part of rebirth. He was also responsible for taking criminals those bodies of criminals that he kept under his wings, he was responsible for taking them to the underworld realm, where other dragons would then eat their souls.
Men, you have sinned. You are a crook and a terrible person. Men. The dragon will carry off your soul and your corpse to the underworld. Men, where more dragons will feast on your soul in the underworld. Men.
It's metal. If you're a bad person, a dragon is going to take you to an underworld of dragons, and you're going to get eaten by dragons. Fucking Dragonception. I'm just going to talk about a few more dragon tales, I promise. Just a couple. This next one I wanted to talk about because it's another one I feel like Tolkien was directly inspired by, and you'll see why. It's another Norse dragon named Fafnir. Fafnir didn't start out as a dragon. He started out as a strong, stout dwarf warrior, and he was the son of a king named Hreidmar. Hreidmar had another son who was killed, and for this loss, he asked the god Odin to pay him a bunch of gold. He's like, my son died, please give me gold. And Odin's like, all right, here's a bunch of gold. And he gives him mounds of gold, like heaps of gold, Scrooge McDuck status levels of gold. He's just diving into these piles and piles of gold. And so Hreidmar's remaining son, Fafnir, was a strong, since he was a strong, assertive dwarf, warrior, he was chosen to guard these heaps and heaps of gold. But Fafnir, even though he's strong and has this physical prowess, he's kind of a scumbag. And he's like, you know what? I want this gold. And he kills his father and steals all of the gold. And his greed for the gold was so great that not only was he willing to kill his own father for it, he physically transformed into a dragon to guard the gold. His gold lust imbued him with magic powers. His greed transformed him into a dragon. And he wreaked havoc on anyone who went near his piles of gold. He would breathe poisonous vapors at them, or he would, you know, just swipe at their face and just gnarl them to death. So the king actually had a third son. There was the son who died. There was Fafnir. And then there was Fafnir's brother. His name was Regan. And Regan gets a small band of people together to fight Fafnir, to avenge his father and reclaim the gold that was stolen, and to kill his dragon brother. And Regan and his crew go out on a quest to find an epic sword named Gram. And they procure Gram and use it to cut off Fafnir's head in this epic dragon battle. And Gram just... because I felt like putting this little note in here. Gram is also a sword. It's this really epic sword that's featured in a bunch of Norse tales. It's this like legendary item that if you get it, you're pretty much winning the fight. And that's how Regan and his crew were able to kill Fafnir. And then also a very, very metal thing happens after this. Regan is like, let's eat his heart. And he asks his companion, Sigurd, to cook the heart for him. And Sigurd says, okay. So he cuts the heart out of Fafnir's chest and begins to cook it. And as it's cooking, he reaches into the pan to give the heart a taste. But he burns his hand and he recoils it and he pulls it to his mouth. He tastes the heart and suddenly begins to understand the language of the birds, which I know the story's really trippy. They're eating dragon hearts, and then he's like, I can hear the birds. So Regan's friend, Sigurd, is communing with the birds. He starts having these visions. And whether these visions are from madness or they're real visions, you know, that's all open for debate. But the birds tell Sigurd that Regan is planning to kill him. So instead, Sigurd kills Regan and runs off with the treasure. I know, it's a weird ending to the story, but that's how it's written. I didn't write it, I'm just retelling it. Regan doesn't get any of the gold. He gets killed by his companion, and the companion runs off with all the gold and the power of hearing birds. He also appears, Sigurd appears in other tales after this story, and he becomes another character that is interwoven in other Norse tales. But like I said, that tale seems to have been a direct inspiration for dragons of Middle-earth, dragons of Arda. In The Hobbit, there's Smaug, a dark and evil dragon that hoards heaps of gold from dwarves that attempt to reclaim it. Very on the nose, Tolkien. Or should I say, very on the Norse, Tolkien. I shouldn't say that. No, I shouldn't. I hate myself. No one can hate me more than I hate myself. Which brings me to my favorite dragons. And you already guessed it. I'm going for my two favorite dragons. I'm going with one from Tolkien's universe as my first one. And that dragon is Glaurung. Glaurung is an implement of destruction created by Tolkien's primary villain in the First Age, Morgoth. He pops up over and over again throughout his tales, in the Silmarillion, the Fall of Gondolin, the Children of Húrin. He's even mentioned in the Lord of the Rings, which I mention him now because I am, like, deeply immersed in this world. I've been deeply immersed in this world for the majority of my life, and he pops up in so many of Tolkien's stories as just this terrible poison-spewing dragon that was created in Morgoth's fortress of Angband. His sole purpose is to destroy. But he is, however, if you haven't read The Children of Húrin, spoilers here, I'm going to pause for a sec, skip forward like 10 seconds if you don't want to hear this next part. Glaurung is slain by Turin after much death and destruction. He was created after Morgoth realized that his orcs alone couldn't fight against the free people of Tolkien's world. So he created a creature that would have elves and men wither before him. A true serpent of dread, of fear and destruction. Also, he is the centerpiece to so many battles across the Middle-earth universe. The universe of Arda. For me, he is the epitome of what a dragon of this nature is all about. My second favorite dragon actually isn't from the Tolkien universe. And it's kind of basically a polar opposite from Glaurung. My second favorite has to go to the good luck dragon, Falkor, from A Neverending Story. And some of that is because way back, long ago, in a long distant time, long, many, many years, many moons ago, when people rented VHS tapes, I was just a child. And in the video stores, or at least the one that we went to, there was this rack of videos that were free for kids when their parents rented a video. The kids could go to the rack and be like, pick out a free video. And I would always pick out either The Brave Little Toaster or A Neverending Story. And I remember watching it with my sister on our very busted VCR. And on our VCR, the tracking wasn't auto. It didn't have auto tracking. And for those of you who are too young to know about VCR tracking, tracking was like the alignment of the tape inside of the VCR. Like VHS tapes have this big spool of film inside of them, and it gets wound into the VHS tape gets wound into the VCR and all of these like mechanisms. But sometimes the spool of film wouldn't quite set up right on the on all the flimflams and doodads inside of the VCR. And there would be like tracking issues. The picture would look really like wobbly, or there'd be lines through it, or it'd look kind of like sideways. And eventually newer VCRs had this thing called auto tracking that would take care of all that for you. But my sister and I were working with a classic VCR where you had to spin this little knob on the front of it to get the tracking just right. So my version of Falcor, it was always a little sideways or wobbly or had some like lines through him. But Falcor, he was more like an Asian dragon. He was a friend and he was a mystical ally. He kind of looks like a dog. He has a very dog-esque face and he even has dog legs. But he also has like on the top of him, he has scales. And he didn't have wings, but he could obviously fly. And he also had like really really big, like droopy dog eyes, like very kind eyes though. He was always winking. That was his thing. He'd like look and be like, everything's gonna be okay, buddy. Wink. He was the steed of the main character in A Neverending Story, Atreyu. And he fought with him against the main antagonist, the Nothing. If you haven't seen A Neverending Story, just right now, just turn this podcast off and go find it and watch it. You can thank me later. And then after you've watched it, you can come back to this episode. But right now, go watch A Neverending Story if you haven't seen it. Or if you have seen it, just stop listening now. Go watch it. This brings me to one of our last segments coming up. I promise not to keep you too much longer. But this next segment is Let's Ask AI.
Let's Ask AI.
I asked AI, how many dragons would it take to conquer Earth in 2023? And AI responded, that's a good question. The answer would depend on a number of factors, including the size and strength of the dragons, the level of technology available to humans, and the strategies used by both sides. If we assume that the dragons are large and powerful, and that the humans have only basic weapons and defenses, then the number of dragons needed to conquer Earth would be small, perhaps just a few dozen. However, if the dragons are smaller or less powerful, or if humans have access to more advanced technologies, it might take a very large number of dragons to conquer Earth, perhaps hundreds, thousands, or even millions. Ultimately, it's impossible to say for sure how many dragons it would take to conquer Earth. It would depend on a number of factors that are difficult to predict. Here are some additional factors that would affect the number of dragons needed to conquer Earth. The location of the dragons. If the dragons were able to launch a surprise attack on a major city, they could potentially conquer a large area with a relatively small number of dragons. The level of cooperation among the dragons. If humans were able to unite and coordinate their efforts, they would be much more likely to be able to defeat the dragons. The dragons' goals. If the dragons were only interested in conquering a small area, they would need fewer dragons than if they were interested in conquering the entire world. Of course, this is all speculation. The real answer to the question of how many dragons it would take to conquer Earth would depend on a number of factors that we can't predict. But it's an interesting thought experiment to consider. And for me, after hearing this response, I'm like, this is why we need to come together as a species. So if and when the dragons come back, we are united and we can stop them. And maybe we could employ the help of other good dragons. We could have the Asian dragons come in and fight the evil European dragons. We could maybe mod the dragons with tech. We could outfit them with laser cannons or like give them bionic appendages. I don't know. AI also said the dragons' goals. Like, what are the what what other goals would a dragon, would an evil dragon have other than destruction and claiming treasure? Like, I don't, like, I don't get that AI. Like, maybe the dragons are, you know, that kind of got me thinking, like, if evil dragons did take over, would they set up little dragon houses with little dragon schools and go to their dragon jobs? Would they squabble online over dragon-related news and politics? Or maybe they'd, you know, maybe they'd eventually be attacked by an even bigger menace than dragons. Maybe we need the dragons to take over. Maybe we could be their thralls, and they could protect us from an even bigger threat, like galactic Time Lords or something. I don't know. Maybe it's time for dragons to take this thing back. Anyway, dragons are tight. Dragons are really fun. Let's get on to our next segment, known as the fun facts segment of the show. And honestly, I feel like this entire episode has been nothing but fun facts about dragons. And I've just been going on and on and on about types of dragons, dragon origins, stories about dragons. So with the fun facts, I decided to stay in the vein of fantasy and whimsical stuff, but I wanted to also kind of deviate just a little bit. I'm going to talk a little about some facts from fantasy. Fantasy books, fantasy movies, fantasy shows that aren't directly about dragons. The first fun fact comes from the show Game of Thrones. Peter Dinklage didn't want to be on Game of Thrones because after accepting his role in the second Narnia movie, he didn't want to become typecasted as another stereotypical dwarf. But after the showrunners explained his character on, like, who his character was going to be on Game of Thrones, he really liked, that character, and he was like, you know, even though this is going to be another dwarf role, I'm going to accept it. I'm taking it. I love this character. I love that he's this sort of like anti-hero. Anyway, I haven't even finished Game of Thrones. I know that's like sacrilege. I've only seen a little bit just because there's so much content out there, and I need to give it. I need to just sit down and binge it. I feel like it's the only way I'm going to finish it. But I do, from what I have seen of Game of Thrones, I do love his character. He's definitely one of my favorites. The next fun fact is about the movie Legend. In Legend, actor Tim Curry wore a massive amount of prosthetics. If you haven't at least seen an image from this movie, just go ahead and like look it up real quick. The main antagonist that Tim Curry portrays in Legend has this massive muscular devil face with giant black horns. And the prosthetic took around 5 hours to put on each time they needed Tim Curry for the day. And Curry was super irritated each time he had to wear it. And if you did see a picture, or if you did look up a picture of the movie, or at least his character in the movie, you can see why. Just the weight of all of that alone would have been super annoying. And anyway, at the end of one of the shoots, he had had enough. And he was like, I gotta get these prosthetics off my face. And he started like just ripping them off, just like pulling them off of his face. And I guess when he did this, he, you know, unintentionally started ripping out large chunks of his skin from his face as well. So they had to like stop production for a minute until he could like kind of heal from that for a little bit. The next fun fact is from Willow. And it actually has to do with CGI. Willow was the first movie to feature all digital morphing. There are several scenes in Willow where humans morph into animals or animals morph into other animals. There's one scene specifically where there's like, he's like having these animals morph into other animals and then at the end morphs into a human. And before Willow, sure, there were scenes where people changed into animals and animals changed into other animals and so on and so forth, but Willow was the first movie to go all digital with it. And honestly, I looked it up on Google because I've seen Willow, but it's been a long time. It looks really good. It like really doesn't look bad I was like, dang, this looks pretty impressive for being the first digital morphing, like animal-human morphing sequence. It looks pretty good. You can find clips of it on YouTube if you want to check it out, but just keep in mind it is from 1988, and that will like add to the coolness of it, or at least it did for me. The next fun fact is a very simple one. It's a very short one. The word fantasy comes from the Latin word fantasia, which means imagination. I just thought that was a cool, fun little tidbit. I'm going to do just a few more, and then we're going to wrap this thing up. For this next one, I wanted to figure out what the first fantasy book ever written was. And honestly, that is just a super broad question after I thought about it. Like, considering what actually constitutes as fantasy, it's really an umbrella term for otherworldly stories, and like mystical characters have been around for thousands of years. Stories of supernatural things, stories of wild creatures, stories of epic battles. But I didn't want to just kind of like leave it at that. So I decided to refine my search a little bit. And I wanted to figure out what the first full-on published book that dealt with an entire overarching story that had magic users, warriors, kingdoms, possibly like elves and dwarves or knights, all those modern fantasy tropes that we all know and love. I wanted to figure out like who wrote that book, who threw all of those elements together into one story. And it was really hard to get to the bottom of who was the first to publish the first modern, that's my term. Well, it's not, I didn't create the term modern fantasy, but that's the term I'm using for this, is like who created this like first modern fantasy book, because the lines here are so blurred. I found a lot of information about it, because there's so many parallels between myths and legends and reality. But I came across one book that I think fits the description. Although there was a book that came in second place called The King of the Golden River that kept popping up and actually predates the one that I chose, I feel like after reading the overall plot description of both books, that the winner is The Princess and the Goblin. They take first place because there's a king, there's a princess, there are goblins, there's the use of magic, there's like mystical realms and caves going on. I just think it fits the description of what a modern fantasy looks like best. So, sorry that was a super long-winded fact, but as far as I can tell, the first modern fantasy novel appears to be The Princess and the Goblin. That's another thing I'd like to, if you have any input on that, let me know. What do you think the first modern fantasy? And I'm not talking like high fantasy. I'm not talking like, you know, Tolkien's works or things like that. I'm talking about like the first collection of these elements, of fantasy elements, all coalescing into one story like this. If you have a different opinion on what that is, so I guess that's more of a fun opinion rather than a fun fact. Or I don't know if you can completely pinpoint this question into a fact. But I did some research, and as far as I can tell, this is the one. Let's do two more short ones, and then we'll wrap it up. The largest fantasy video game of all time, and by largest I mean the one that has sold the most and has the most active users, is World of Warcraft. It's a game that's been out since 2004, and it still has over 8 million active users worldwide in 2023. And I've played it once. I played on a friend's profile just to like see what was going on, and I was like, oh, this is a vortex into another dimension. And I like have actively like not played it again, because I could see myself getting lost in that world. I really want to get lost in that world, but I just don't know if I should. The next fun fact is that the first fantasy comic book to be awarded the Eisner Award for Best Continuing Series was Sandman by Neil Gaiman, which is another thing I have not read that I really do need to read. Fantasy, dragons and fantasy throughout your mind. Throughout your mind, the dragons and fantasy flow. They fly from the skies, they fly down to you, the fantasy of your mind. We create this art together. We blossom new ideas, the fantasy, the dragon soar through the night. The dragon soar with delight. They show the way to the water, the way through your mind, the way to the fantasy, feeling fine. Fantasy. Thank you for letting me do that. Remember that you are in control. You are writing your story. You are the author, and you create your destiny. Remember to check on your mental health, and remember to check on the mental health of your loved ones. Bye. Thoughts. Analog thoughts. Analog thoughts.